Hello and welcome to Live. I'm Royal Lady McLean, and tonight I'm joined by Helena, aka No Justice MTG, on YouTube and Twitch. Helena, hello.
Always good to be joining you as a co-host, Maya. Looking forward to the show today.
Right, well, we've got a big one. Coming up later tonight, the Scottish Government have dropped an emissions target for 2030. Sex workers are speaking out against banking discrimination, and the latest scandal to come from a Tory MP. And this one is truly bizarre. Stay tuned for all of that, but first we'll be discussing the latest developments around Israel's war in Gaza and the growing tensions with Iran. First story. While Israel ponders its response to Iran's retaliatory attack on the country last weekend, the US and the UK have acted to support their ally. Both governments have issued new sanctions packages on Iran, targeting individuals and suppliers of weapons parts. In a statement, US President Joe Biden said this. Less than a week ago, Iran launched one of the largest missile and drone attacks the world has ever seen against Israel. Together with our allies and partners, the United States defended Israel. We helped defeat this attack. And today, we are holding Iran accountable, imposing new sanctions and export controls on Iran. The sanctions target leaders and entities connected to the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, Iran's defense ministry, and the Iranian government's missile and drone program that enabled this brazen assault. As I discussed with my fellow G7 leaders the morning after the attack, we are committed to acting collectively to increase economic pressure on Iran. And our allies and partners have or will issue additional sanctions and measures to restrict Iran's destabilizing military programs. Now, the US and the UK's sanctions target the manufacturers and servicers of engines for Iran's drones, as well as 8 companies involved in Iran's steel and auto industries. Additionally, the UK has placed sanctions on Iran's military forces, but these will make little difference because Iran is already under inhibiting US and UK sanctions, which include an almost complete economic embargo and a total ban on arms sales. As a result, Iran's economy is very much not dependent on Western cooperation. It's kept afloat by oil, about 1.5 million barrels a day, which then enters the international oil markets via China. Of course, Biden or Rishi Sunak could try and target that supply, but neither leader wants a massive hike in energy prices, especially when each is facing an election later this year. That leaves their hands more or less tied when it comes to economic measures. The EU has also imposed new sanctions on Iran, but its leaders are striking a more confrontational note than the US or UK when it comes to Israel. This is EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell.
We have to ask Israel for a restrained answer to the Iranians' attack. We cannot escalate. We cannot go step by step answering every time higher to a regional war. I don't want to exaggerate, but we are on the edge of a war, a regional war in the Middle East, which will be sending shockwaves to the rest of the world, and in particular to Europe. So stop it. Take care of the Gazan people, ceasefire, humanitarian support, freedom of hostages.
Far from stopping, Israel seems intent on carrying out a further attack on Iran. The former intelligence director of Israel's spy agency Mossad spoke to Sky News, where he said this about Israel's intentions.
I like when the Iranian will be in anxiety right now. And it's okay to wait for the time and the right moment when we will feel that we will hit something significant. And not just something not relevant to say that we retaliate just because everybody wants to close this issue. I want to leave this account open and to strike and to do something that will be significant that the Iranian will understand. Don't mess with the Israelis. Simple as that. And for the international community, I don't remember that after Pearl Harbor or other attacks in the history, somebody restrains someone. And we didn't done nothing against Iran's soil per se, overtly. And it seems to me that there will be implication for that. When and where, we will choose the place.
In anticipation of an Israeli attack, Iran has been issuing its own threats of what might follow from any assault. The country has now said that if Israel attacks, it would review its nuclear doctrine. What that means in practice isn't clear. Tehran has long said that its nuclear program is intended for entirely peaceful ends. But a senior Iranian military official today said this. The nuclear facilities of the Zionist enemy have been identified, and all necessary information from all targets is at our disposal. Our fingers are on the trigger of firing strong missiles to destroy the designated targets in response to a potential attack by them. If the fake Zionist regime wants to use the threat of attacking the nuclear centers of our country as a tool, reconsidering the doctrine and policies of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and deviating from previously stated considerations would be likely unimaginable. All of this sudden and dramatic escalation stems from Israel's attack on the Iranian embassy in Damascus. And it's now emerged that Israel may not only have acted violently, but incredibly recklessly too. Israeli officials miscalculated the reaction that Iran would have to the Damascus attack, reports the New York Times. And Israel carried out the attack without running it past its biggest ally, the US. The report says this on Israel's planning for the Damascus attack. About a week beforehand, on March 22nd, the Israeli War Cabinet approved the operation according to the internal Israeli defense records that summarized preparations for the strike. Those records also outlined the range of responses from Iran that the Israeli government expected, among them small-scale attacks by proxies and a small-scale attack from Iran. None of the assessments predicted the ferocity of the Iranian response that actually occurred. From the day of the strike, Iran vowed retaliation, both publicly and through diplomatic channels. But it also sent messages privately that it did not want outright war with Israel, and even less so with the United States, and it waited 12 days to attack. Israel clearly acted without a proper assessment before attacking Iran's consulate. And the question of Israel's recklessness came up in Politics Live when Navarra media contributor Dahlia Gabriel clashed with Tory peer Stuart Jackson.
I was describing the atrocities of the autocratic access to try and get moral clarity that while Western liberal democracies are by no means perfect, we want them to win. This is why migrants from all over the world want to come to the West and not to China or to Russia. These are evil people. Yeah. And unless we are prepared to spend to deter and prevent war, we will go to World War III.
Dahlia?
It's highly likely if we don't spend on defence.
I think it's a very childlike view of the world to simply see things as good and evil. We need to look at the real political situation that is unfolding. And if we're going to talk about it from a place of moral superiority, which I believe we should be able to do, I believe that that is important in politics, we cannot claim that moral superiority when we are continuing to arm a state that has shown nothing but recklessness and nothing but disdain for the for the rulings of the highest international court
in the
Do I live in Tehran or do I live in Britain?
We don't live in Israel either.
You can't claim moral superiority. You cannot claim moral superiority and then violate your own norms.
Israel are the front lines of civilization. I mean, it's very telling, isn't it, about that particular Tory cohort's ideas about Israel as this Western outpost, which we know, but he's saying the quiet part out loud. I dread to think what people who are watching mainstream media as their only source of information are getting an understanding about the dynamics of what is going on in Israel, in Iran, with Gaza. Because anyone watching, you know, Stuart Jackson talking is not going to get a better understanding of the geopolitics that is governing these tensions and is governing Israel's attacks and why Israel is allowed to attack everyone with impunity at this point and why someone like Stuart Jackson would think that Israel is the front line of civilization. And another question is, why is it that whenever someone tries to approach geopolitics from a, you know, more dispassionate and neutral perspective, it has to immediately be turned into a team sport? What Dahlia is doing there is analysing the consequences of certain courses of action by the West, very obvious consequences of the kind that Israel did not seem able to foresee when it bombed the consulate in Damascus. And yet suddenly that means you're on Team Iran, you've got your little pompons out. Helena, what did you make of that exchange?
What's very frustrating about all of this, when you talk about things like sanctions being placed on Iran, now, of course, I'm not going to try and come here as some kind of Iran stan. There are plenty of issues that I have with them. I think their domestic politics is pretty abhorrent. And whether or not you think sanctions work is a completely different matter as to whether or not you apply them in a manner that is befitting of what people do. And to say that we want to have more sanctions on Iran because they attacked Israel, I'm like, well, hang on a minute. They explicitly attacked military targets, which even the IDF admit, it was Netzavim Air Base, I believe, that all their weapons were armed against. And yet this was in retaliation to Israel breaking the Vienna Convention, attacking Iran at their consulate in Damascus. Honestly, it's crazy that the people can even get to this kind of the position that we see from people like Stuart Jackson in terms of where they land in terms of how we discuss geopolitics. It's really, honestly, Israel acts like a spoiled child, really and truly. They act like a spoiled child at this point, where first of all, they can essentially kind of strong-arm Joe Biden to say, well, we're going to escalate World War III unless you let us attack Rafah, despite Biden saying, well, you're not allowed to attack Rafah. And then also on top of that, we didn't realize that we weren't allowed to attack the embassy, but I'm sure we'll get away with it because people like Stuart Jackson, all the other people, will not hold them to proper international standards when it comes to the actions of our allies rather than our enemies. And that's why it's absolutely 100%, you described it as being team sports. That's literally what it is. The amount of times that I've seen discussions like we just watched there between Dahlia and Mr. Jackson, where the response from people is to say, oh, well, Israel's our ally and Iran is our enemy. And that's all that matters. That's all that matters when it comes to geopolitical discussion. Who's the goodies and who's the baddies? As Dahlia said specifically, it's childlike simplicity in terms of how we discuss these issues. And if you don't have something that you can apply unilaterally to everybody, like international law, having this international rules-based order, which of course we've all seen gets continually undermined by the West with total impunity, and by Israel, of course, continually undermining international law. We fundamentally understand that the more that the West is allowed to get away with not adhering to the rules that they set other people, the more likely it is that other sectors of the geopolitical sphere will take that as a way in which that they can also ignore those things, and things will escalate in the way that we've seen. This is why I had to start the entirety of my contribution to this particular part of this discussion by having this whole disclaimer about how, well, just because I'm saying this thing that defends the actions of Iran in completely neutral and fact-based terms doesn't mean I support what they say. Because as soon as you try and move out of this team sports dynamic of political discussion, people will start acting in the way that they acted about Jeremy Corbyn having kind of similar views from 2015 to 2019, by calling you a terrorist sympathiser, or thinking you're fraternising, you're an enemy of Britain or something, rather than, of course, thinking, well, hang on a minute, if we don't uphold the rules-based international order, if we don't apply international law unilaterally rather than only when we deem it necessary for our own geopolitical interests, there is also going to be blowback in the future. The potential escalation because Israel's government, the Netanyahu administration, are twisting the arms of Western nations, using essentially emotional blackmail over, well, we'll let us do this or we'll start World War III potentially. And of course, that is our own fault for letting them get away with this stuff for so long. And so unless we properly apply these principles universally, all we're going to be doing is causing more oil price shocks for ourselves, more refugee crises for ourselves, more political instability, and the potential for the most kind of the most tragic and most unthinkable circumstances if this regional war escalates and places like the US and the UK get involved. Because we will. We will end up being forced to get involved in these issues because, of course, we just end up doing whatever the US State Department wants. And A, they are fully happy, as we've seen, to give so much credence to what Israel wants on these issues. And it's dangerous. It's very dangerous.
Very true. I'm fed up of talking about politics as a team sport, but it seems people just cannot divest from that framework. Now, the possibility of a hot war, a phrase I'm fed up of hearing, between Israel and Iran is occupying headlines. But that means that attention is turned away from Gaza, where Israel appears to be preparing to begin its ground operation on Rafah. The country has reportedly deployed extra armoured personnel carriers and weapons to the periphery of the Gaza Strip. It's also purchased 40,000 tents to prepare for the evacuation of civilians, which doesn't sound like nearly enough when there are 1.5 million Palestinians sheltering there. The US, the UK and the EU have all been clear with Israel, publicly at least, that it should not invade Rafah. But a Qatari news outlet has reported that the US might be using Rafah as a grim bargaining chip as it tries to stop Israel from starting a war with Iran. One Egyptian official told Al Arabi Al Jadid this. The American administration showed acceptance of the plan previously presented by the occupation government regarding the military operation in Rafah in exchange for not carrying out a large-scale attack against Iran. An official in the US State Department denied that claim, but it would fit with the US's almost total disregard for Palestinian life and rights. Tonight, the UN Security Council will vote on allowing Palestine full membership of the international body. Currently, Palestine has non-member observer status at the UN. Full membership requires the agreement of the Security Council and one-third of the General Assembly. The US is widely expected to veto the resolution later tonight in what would appear to be a direct contradiction with its stated policy of pursuing a two-state solution. Now, obviously, the US would rather not have exposed its barefaced hypocrisy on the world stage, which is why, as The Intercept reports, it's been trying to get other countries to do its dirty work for it. Leaked cables show that the White House firmly opposes Palestinian statehood, arguing that the nation should not be granted UN member status. According to The Intercept, the leaked cables show the US applying pressure to members of the Security Council. These include Malta, which currently holds the presidency of the Council, and France. One of those cables from the 12th of April says this. It remains the US view that most expeditious path towards a political horizon for the Palestinian people is in the context of normalization agreement between Israel and its neighbors. We believe this approach can tangibly advance Palestinian goals in a meaningful and enduring way. We therefore urge you not to support any potential Security Council resolution recommending the admission of a Palestine as a UN member state, should such a resolution be presented to the Security Council for a decision in the coming days and weeks. Normalization between Israel and its neighbours means greater integration of Israel into the region. It essentially marks the acceptance of the Arab nations of Israel and the conditions in which it keeps the Palestinians, and it cuts off Palestine from the support offered by regional sanctions and non-cooperation against Israel. The reason that the US supports it is because normalization would, in effect, make the Palestinians weaker and therefore, so the theory goes, less able to resist their oppressor. It's no wonder that many Palestinians have been against the process, maybe because they see it as one that puts greater pressure on them to accept as normal the utterly abnormal state of apartheid in which they're forced to exist. Let's go to our next story. The Scottish government has announced that they are dropping a key climate target after being told it is, quote, unachievable. This was Scottish Net Zero Secretary Mary McAllen in Holyrood today speaking about the goal to reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 75% by 2030.
In this challenging context of cuts, UK backtracking, we accept the CCC's recent rearticulation that this Parliament's interim 2030 target is out of reach. We must now act to chart a course to 2045 at a pace and a scale that is feasible, fair and just.
The SNP and the Greens are blaming this rollback on the Tory UK government.
With this ambitious new package, allow there to be no doubt about the seriousness with which this government treats the climate and nature crises and our readiness to act, to deliver. We must, however, acknowledge that we do so in difficult circumstances. The Climate Change Committee is clear, and I quote, that the UK is already substantially off track for 2030, and achieving future UK carbon budgets will, I quote, require sustained increase in the pace and breadth of decarbonisation across most major sectors. Indeed, we do see climate backtracking at UK level. With severe budgetary restrictions imposed by the UK government and under the continuing constraints of devolution, we are trying to achieve societal and economic transformation with one hand tied behind our back. Indeed, such is the UK's unprecedented economic mismanagement that full delivery of our plans will be contingent on the UK government reversing the 9% cut to our capital budget.
To try and soften the news, McAllen also announced a new package of energy measures, including a new carbon land tax consultation, support for electric vehicle transition and food producers, plus pilot scheme for methane suppression on farms. But these new pledges will do little to soften the blow of dropping the government's flagship climate pledge. The SNP made the promise in 2019, alongside introducing legislation to ensure targets were met. But after missing 8 of the last annual climate targets, ministers were told the 2030 goal was not possible. The target of reaching net zero by 2045 remains, although the precedent set by dropping the flagship climate pledge doesn't exactly inspire confidence. There is also concern that annual climate targets may be dropped too. Speaking to BBC Scotland, campaign group Friends of the Earth Scotland slammed the decision as, quote, the worst environmental decision in the history of the Scottish Parliament. They continued. The Scottish Government has had 15 years to bring forward the transformative action that would mean warm homes, good public transport and good green jobs. They haven't delivered. Instead of ramping up action, they're scrapping targets and breaking promises. There's also been dissent from inside the government. Scotland's International Development Minister, Kakoub Stewart, told the BBC this. With the measures that we are taking locally in Glasgow with active travel, investing in hydrogen buses, we are making progress on that. I am very disappointed. In First Minister's questions, Scottish First Minister, Hamza Youssef, faced a grilling from opposition parties. Scottish Labour leader Anas Sawa took the moment to remind Youssef how he had reacted to the Conservative UK government rolling back on their climate targets.
When Hamza Youssef was standing to be leader of his party, he promised to meet and better Scotland's climate targets. And when Rishi Sunak rolled back on the UK's climate commitments, the First Minister said that he had no intention to change the target dates. This is what he had to say about Rishi Sunak. The UK government's actions in the face of that climate catastrophe are simply unforgivable. What the UK government are saying is that we can roll back on our commitments and it is the planet, it is people that will suffer the effects. And now today, this SNP Green government is going to roll back on its climate commitments. So why is Hamza Youssef following the Tories' lead?
Youssef defended his government, saying the reports were misleading.
Untrue. And it's probably, Presiding Officer, why it's wise to actually listen to the detail of a parliamentary statement before, of course, simply coming forward with misleading and mischaracterisation of our position. What I would say,
Presiding Officer, let's hear the First Minister.
Is, as the Parliament will hear later this afternoon, there is no intention to roll back from that 2045 date in order for us to reach net zero. In order for us to reach net zero, of course, 5 years ahead of the UK government, in order for us to continue to have more ambitious climate change targets than Labour-run Wales, for example. Our presiding officer, we, of course, have made progress. Between 1990 and 2021, we've reduced our carbon emissions faster than any other nation in the UK. But let me also be clear, this government will not move back by, as I say, a single month, a week, or even a day from that 2045 target to achieving net zero.
However, no one said the 2045 targets had been scrapped yet. The reports were all about the 2030 targets being scrapped, which they have been. Earlier today, I spoke to economist and the co-director of Future Economies Scotland, Laurie McFarlane. Laurie is carrying out research on a just transition in Scotland, and I started by asking him why the SNP and Green Coalition are rolling back climate targets like the UK Tories.
The reason the Scottish Government's rolling back on climate targets, it's not because they no longer want to achieve the 2030 net zero target. It's because it has become very, very obvious and undeniable, really, that it cannot be achieved. The 2030 target was to reduce emissions by 75%, and that was set in 2019. And one interesting thing is, at the time, the Climate Change Committee had said to the Scottish Government, that's not going to be possible. You should really be going for something like 66 to 68%. But the Scottish Government wanted to be ambitious, and so it went for the 75%. And unfortunately, while the Scottish Government showed quite commendable leadership in setting ambitious targets, they've consistently failed to actually take the action needed to deliver them and decarbonise key sectors. So Scotland's failed to meet 8 out of the last 12 annual climate targets and has really been dragging its heels and avoiding tough decisions on many of the key sectors. And so I think this has actually been a long time coming, and it's really sort of symptomatic of a government that likes to talk the talk, but isn't necessarily walking the walk, anything like the scale that it needs to be.
So why have they missed targets? In the speech made to Holyrood this afternoon, devolution was among one of the reasons they gave.
There are really two things going on here. The first is that the Scottish government, with the powers that it has, just hasn't done enough. As I say, there's been lots of feet dragging, particularly on areas like agriculture, heating, buildings, where in fact it could have done more over recent years, but for various reasons, you know, hasn't, because there's been various other things, you know, the pandemic, etc., but also, frankly, politics, and they've just not taken that bold, decisive action where they could have done. Now, there is a question as to whether or not the 2030 target, i.e. reduced by 75%, was ever really possible, given the powers and the fiscal powers, particularly, that the Scottish government has, because a lot of this needs money, investment. And the Scottish government's investment budget, when it comes to capital spending, is fixed and largely determined by Westminster. And the Scottish government has very trivial borrowing powers. And so in the context of where the UK government hasn't been investing in net zero and anywhere near the scale it needs to be, that's been challenging because it's created fiscal challenges for Scotland. And so there is an element of truth that some of this, you know, wasn't ever possible, but certainly there's a lot more the Scottish government could have done. And certainly I think the 2030 target, if that was in the context of, say, a UK government, UK-wide approach, doing an ambitious Green New Deal, you know, big investment, then I think that would have been viable. With a Conservative government at the UK level who's actually cutting public investment, I think it was always a very tall order, to be frank.
So the Scottish government say they're not scrapping these yearly targets yet, but they are meant to be legally binding. However, they've missed the majority of them. Are there any legal repercussions for this?
So the net zero target, both the 2030 and the 2045, were enshrined in law. And they were actually designed to be quite difficult to change, not impossible, but difficult. But I guess, like with other laws, laws are laws until Parliament decides to change them. And so today, the Scottish government has confirmed that it is scrapping the annual and interim targets that were in place. So it is actually scrapping them, and they're replacing it with a system of measuring emissions every 5 years and a carbon budgeting system that's similar to that of the UK and Welsh government. So it is rolling back on a commitment that was legally binding. And really, that's because it really had to, because otherwise, as I say, if it got to 2030 and it wasn't reached, it would have been breaching its own legal commitments.
What is the impact of rolling back on climate pledges? The government insists that they're still as committed to this ambitious anti-climate change agenda as ever. But do we have evidence of what happens when you do pull back from big climate targets?
Well, just this afternoon, the Cabinet Secretary for Net Zero, Mary McCallan, set out a speech in Parliament where she announced this raft of new policies. And I think really that's designed to try and sort of reassure confidence that this is something the Scottish government is still committed to. Obviously, it begs the question, why has it taken them to roll back on a legal target before announcing these new policies? Because they could have been done before. And I think there's some good stuff in there. It's a starting point, but it's certainly nowhere near the ambition that's needed. In terms of the wider effect, though, I think what this does, it really undermines confidence in bold action on climate change. The Scottish government had positioned itself very vocally globally that it was a global leader, having one of the most ambitious climate targets in the world. And to have, you know, now not that far in, have to actually publicly say, actually, we're rowing back on it, it really does undermine confidence. But crucially, it also gives ammunition to critics and to those who actually want to undermine climate action, climate skeptics, etc., who say, oh, well, see, it was never possible, etc. And so, you know, I think politically it's tricky. I do think, though, the Scottish government is still committed to bold action on climate change. It's reaffirmed its commitment to 2045. And crucially, I think the 2045 target is still doable. That is the big one. It is doable. The Climate Change Committee agrees as well. It does just mean that we can't continue sort of talking the talk and not walking the walk. And so these initial policies announced today, I think, are a starting point. But we really do need to see a much bolder, more proactive approach to policy across the board in Scotland.
What does walking the walk mean? What would have to happen in order for net zero to be reached by 2045? Some of those policies were things like, you know, supporting the transition to EV vehicles or piloting schemes for reducing methane emissions. What specifically needs to be done in order for Scotland to meet its 2045 net zero target?
So there's a whole range of things in different areas. So Scotland has obviously is home to the UK's oil and gas sector, the majority of it at least. And so phasing out oil and gas is obviously crucial. Many of those powers are reserved, but the Scottish Government has a really important role to play in supporting that just transition, scaling up those other green industries to make sure that we are protecting livelihoods and transitioning workers. And so there's a lot more to do still on the energy front, renewable energy, and particularly offshore, but also onshore. Things like, I mean, agriculture, it's one of the most frustrating things is post-Brexit, we now have control over the agricultural subsidies once again, and that has devolved to Scotland. Unfortunately, the UK government has actually moved quicker to replace the EU cap system with a system which is far from perfect, but it's moving towards a system which is delivering more in the form of environmental good. The Scottish government's really dragged its heels on that. Transport, again, another devolved area. There is, I think, a lot we can do. Today, the minister just announced plans to have a nationwide integrated ticketing system for public transport, try and make public transport more affordable, integrated and accessible. So these kind of things as well. The big one, though, I think, though, is to have a much more proactive approach to industrial strategy. The Scottish Government hasn't really had an industrial strategy. And just last year, it did come out and commit saying, OK, we are going to develop a green industrial strategy. And really, it's about the role of the state. We know that sitting back and leaving this to the market is simply not going to deliver the structural transformation that's needed. So you need a much more robust, proactive role for the state in the economy, investing, directing, steering decarbonisation and nurturing and scaling up those new industries and technologies. And we haven't really seen that from the Scottish Government yet. The industrial strategy is yet to be published, so we will see what it says. But certainly as a first step, it's really important to be moving in that direction.
That was Laurie McFarlane speaking to me earlier today. Let's go on to our next story. Sex workers are still suffering financial discrimination at the hands of banks. Campaigners say that a key problem faced by sex workers are bank accounts being frozen or account applications being rejected outright. Reporting in the Financial Times and Daily Mail says that automated systems are also barring sex workers from access to regulated banks, forcing them to rely on alternatives and less secure ways of storing their earnings. Research by Decrim Now and the Sex Workers Union found that 80% of members had experienced financial discrimination. Of the estimated 80,000 sex workers in the UK, the vast majority are women. Studies also suggest there are overrepresentations of minority groups in UK sex work. Banks say the decision to freeze accounts or bar access to financial services is based on, quote, risk management and regulatory obligations. However, after a petition last year by Becky Webster, a sex worker who had her accounts closed or refused 15 times by banks, in March 2024, the Treasury announced new measures to protect customers. These include increasing notice banks have to give customers of account closure to 90 days and requiring detailed explanations of the decision. Earlier today, I spoke to Audrey Caradonna, an organiser at Decrim Now. I started by asking her if these Treasury measures were enough.
No, in short. It might give sex workers more notice on whether their accounts are going to be closed, but it's going to do nothing to tackle the root cause of the problem as to why sex workers are consistently having their accounts closed down.
What is the root of the problem? Why are sex workers being repeatedly targeted by financial institutions?
There's a few causes to this problem. One of the large ones is the criminalisation of sex work. Banks say that to offer sex workers financial services would be to take on an alleged risk of criminality. And the laws that are surrounding sex work and the stigma surrounding sex work is what is creating this risk for banks. So we do need the full decriminalisation of sex work in order to help prevent financial discrimination. There's also something to be said as well, I think, for the ways anti-trafficking laws work currently, which isn't necessarily in the most beneficial way. We have a lot of conflation of sex work and trafficking. And whilst these are not two completely separate issues, there is a distinction between sex work and trafficking. And banks are cutting off sex workers' access to financial services due to the alleged risk of trafficking, which actually makes no sense to me, because if you're going to cut off someone's access to financial independence, then you're actually creating the conditions where they're more likely to be exploited or to be re-trafficked.
What happens when workers can't bank with regulated institutions? What are the risks they face?
It has a disastrous impact on sex workers' lives when they can't access financial services. It increases sex workers' reliance on cash, which puts them at a greater risk of crime, of getting their money stolen. As we move to an increasingly cashless society as well, it's enforcing further marginalisation and isolation of sex workers. I mean, I don't really know anyone anymore who pays rent with cash. It's all through direct debit. So if your account gets shut down, how are you meant to pay your rent? How are you meant to pay your bills? We had one sex worker who I spoke to whilst doing research with the Sex Workers Union into this, who was actually evicted because they lost access to their bank account, couldn't pay their rent, and then also was struggling to open up a new bank account and had no option of paying their landlord. So eventually got evicted. There's also the risk that increasingly, if you're on benefits as well, that's paid through direct debit. There's a whole host of ways in which you will be isolated from participating in public, even more so than you already are as a sex worker. And it's just disastrous, really.
This sort of financial discrimination against sex workers, it has a disproportionate impact on women and minority ethnic groups, upon, you know, minorities within that group already, like trans women. Is that right?
Yeah, that's correct. The financial discrimination facing sex workers is often targeted the most. It's those people that need access to financial independence that may not have the luxury of having multiple accounts with different banks. They might just have one bank account, and when that bank account is shut down, that's it. Banks also offer very little recourse to anyone whose account has been shut down. Most of the sex workers that we did research with didn't even get a reason for why their account was shut down from their bank. And those that did get a reason were not really offered any way to challenge the assumption that they're a sex worker or why their account was shut down. A lot of times in those situations, their money was withheld from them as well. It's not as if the bank would close their account down immediately and then send the money over. In some cases, their accounts were frozen for months, even for a year in one case, whilst the bank was looking into whether they were a sex worker or not.
We talked a bit about, you know, trafficking laws and how that interacts with what's happening to sex workers with banks. As systems get more automated, both with the processing of these decisions and the customer-facing systems that people encounter, is that likely to make the problems worse unless the laws change?
We're already seeing how the automated systems within banking are A, targeting sex workers, and then B, making it more difficult for sex workers to access any recourse, especially when you consider that a lot of the sex worker community or a lot of people who've entered sex work have done it because they may be neurodivergent, they may have caring responsibilities, they may have another job that's not paying them enough, they may be single mothers, single parents, and these people might not have the time to go through robot after robot after robot and finally get to someone that they can speak to regarding their banking issues. So a lot of sex workers might just leave it because they don't have the time and don't have the resources to chase that up, which is made even more difficult by an automated process.
Decriminalisation is the full ask from this campaign, but what else can be done in the immediate sense to relieve some of the problems around financial discrimination that sex workers are experiencing in the UK?
Essentially, it's up to banks, because banks are the ones who are deciding that providing services to sex workers is too risky. But I think what banks actually mean when they say that is that providing services to sex workers would require too many resources in order to check whether they were able to provide services to sex workers. Banks hide behind this alleged risk, but are doing nothing to make it less risky for them to provide services to sex workers. I think that the FCA, that banking institutions need to be doing something to make sure that sex workers do have an equitable access to their services.
That was Audrey Caradonna from Decrim Now speaking to me earlier today. Let's go on to our next story. Mark Menzies was a Tory MP who has also acted as a trade envoy for the UK, but no more, because he has been suspended from the Conservative Party and sacked from his diplomatic role. The suspension follows a series of fairly worrying allegations about the misuse of campaign funds revealed by a Times investigation. Here's how the eyebrow-raising story begins. Last December, a 78-year-old woman who had once been Mark Menzies' campaign manager received a phone call at 3:15 a.m. in the morning. The Times reports what she heard. "Are you on your own?" the man said with urgency in his voice. "I've got in with some bad people and they've got me locked in a flat and they want £5,000 to release me." The caller was Mark Menzies, 52, the Conservative MP for Fylde in Lancashire. According to the Times, Menzies asked the former staffer to hand over thousands of pounds from an account containing donations to his election campaign. The story continues. She told Menzies that it was 3:15 a.m. and she couldn't transfer any money without leaving the house. He became angry, allegedly telling her it was a matter of life and death, and demanding she instead lend him money from her own savings, according to an account she had subsequently given to friends in the Conservative Party. The woman refused and told the MP that she would speak to his long-time constituency office manager, Shirley Green, in the morning. A few hours later, Green stumped up the money, telling local Tories she'd cashed in her ISA to do so. By then, the sum demanded had risen to £6,500. Now, when someone tells you in the middle of the night that they need a large sum of money in a life or death situation and you refuse, it's usually for one or two reasons. Either you don't really like the person, or more likely, it's a pattern of behaviour you're all too familiar with. So how had Menzies ended up supposedly locked in a flat with people demanding money from him? The Times article goes on to say this. A source close to Menzies said the MP had met a man on an online dating website and gone to the man's flat before subsequently going with another man to a second address where he continued drinking. It was falsely claimed that he'd been sick at one point, and several people at the address then demanded £5,000, claiming it was for cleaning up and other expenses. The source said Menzies decided to pay them because he was scared of what would happen otherwise, but did not have the funds to transfer the money from his own savings. His aides gave him money as friends who wanted to help. After receiving thousands of pounds from Green, Menzies allegedly summoned a junior staffer to come and collect him from the flat. When the staffer arrived, he too gave Menzies money, handing over all the cash he had on him, a sum amounting to a few hundred pounds. According to the report, Menzies said he owed it to two other men. But that wasn't the end of his request for money, with the Times reporting this. The following day, on another call, Menzies said he needed another £35,000 for medical bills. Told there was no more money in the campaign funds bank account, Menzies was unperturbed. "Oh well, we'll raise some more," he allegedly replied. Shirley Green, who'd handed over the thousands that Menzies had asked her from her own savings, was reportedly later reimbursed from his campaign funds. A source close to Menzies told The Times that Menzies said he had offered to reimburse that campaign account from his own funds, but claimed that the local Tories who controlled the account told him that it wasn't necessary. But this wasn't the first time Menzies had taken money from his campaign's accounts. The Times reports this. 4 years ago, shortly before the outbreak of the pandemic, Menzies called his former campaign manager, seeking £3,000 from campaign funds, she has told friends. He claimed to have personal medical bills due urgently that he could not pay and promised to sell some shares in order to repay the money. The former campaign manager and Green authorised the transfer and Menzies received it. But the MP is understood never to have repaid the money. Instead, he asked for and received a further sum of £4,000. Several years passed before Menzies again received funds from the account in November. By then, Green had been replaced as an administrator by another local party member. The sum received amounted to £7,000. Menzies has not repaid any of the £14,000 he has received from the Business Group Fund, money that had been given by donors for campaigning and not for personal expenses. In January, Shirley Green reported Menzies to Tory chief whip Simon Hart. She accused Menzies of misusing donors' money and alleged abuse of privilege by putting pressure on staff to hand their own money over to him. But despite being made more than 3 months ago, CCHQ has still not completed its investigation into Green's complaint. However, the Times report seems to have now spurred the party into action. A spokesperson for Simon Hart said this. Following a call with the chief whip, Mark Menzies has agreed to relinquish the Conservative whip pending the outcome of an investigation. Mark Menzies has denied the allegations, telling The Times this. I strongly dispute the allegations put to me. I fully complied with all the rules for declarations. As there is an investigation ongoing, I will not be commenting further. The current investigation isn't Menzies' first brush with scandal. In 2014, a Brazilian sex worker told the Daily Mirror that Menzies had paid him for sex and asked him to buy drugs for the MP. Menzies quit as a parliamentary private secretary then and hasn't held a ministerial position since. In 2017, Menzies was questioned by police over accusations that he got a friend's dog drunk, resulting in a street brawl with the owner of the dog. More recently, Menzies has been accused of turning up drunk to a concert in his constituency, kicking over chairs and badgering other attendees. Helena, how did such a misuse of campaign funds and a seeming misuse of Tory party staffers go on so long without action from the whip?
I think at the end of the day, what you have to realise is that the Conservative Party are not interested in the aspect of governance. The role of governance is something that is always secondary when it comes to the Conservative Party's actions. What their singular role is continually staying in power for whether it would be ideological or their own personal enrichment. Now, I'm not saying that applies to every single one of them, of course, or necessarily in this case, but you've got to have a look at the whole kind of actions that they've taken. Of course, if somebody was taking a moral principle towards whether or not that we should properly have a level of transparency over these alleged actions being taken by MPs, again, this is not the first time. This is a long string of all of these issues that we've seen in terms of Conservative Party scandal. MP after MP after MP after MP has been implicated in things that are way, way below the kind of standard that we should expect from our elected representatives. But why would they? What would be the point in them in allowing any of these things to therefore go to something like the police, for example, if necessary, when it could result in negative PR for the party later on down the line? That's not good for your permanent campaign strategy, which we've seen them do loads of times, like essentially using public money to be able to shift barristers from being used to their proper role into making sure that they're doing things in terms of getting asylum claims processed because that's what's politically advantageous for them. Well, this does seem to me really and truly seem to be emblematic, again, if the story here is true, emblematic of the kind of people who have become Conservative Party and politicians in the first place. Those who really don't understand the value of money because they've never had to understand what it's like not to have it, and therefore don't understand the value of other people's money, whether it be, you know, donations coming to the party to engage specifically for campaigning or the personal finances of Tory party staffers. Again, this is just the Conservative Party writ large, as we've seen throughout the Boris Johnson era up to now.
Now, Mark Menzies is one of eight former Conservative MPs currently suspended from the party. He joins other ex-Tory MPs now sitting as independents in Parliament, including William Ragg, who earlier resigned this month after getting embroiled in a catfishing scam. On LBC, Nick Ferrari asked Defence Secretary Grant Shapps why Tory MPs cannot stay away from scandal.
What is the problem with Conservatives and these sorts of incidents?
Well, look, I slightly reject the sort of description there, in as much as people, I'm afraid, in every walks of life who either don't do the right thing or sometimes are troubled individually, perhaps with mental health and other things, which leads them to do things which they shouldn't have done. Those eight aren't all sitting in Parliament.
But why does it take the Times to reveal this? Why didn't the Conservative Party do more earlier, Mr. Shapps?
Well, my understanding was that there was already something underway, that CCHQ, Conservative HQ already had that underway. But the new information has come to light, perhaps through that newspaper. I'm not aware from, and not privy to the details.
So it takes the Times, it takes the newspaper then, to actually bring this investigation to some kind of conclusion. That's the reality,
quite often,
isn't it?
Quite often it is a journalist who uncovers wrongdoing. It seems to have been what's happened in the case of Angela Rayner as well, with the home.
All right, okay, I hear on that.
Well. Journalists are the answer to that.
But lastly on this, with the allegation concerning the use of funds, why wasn't that reported to police immediately?
Well, look, as I said, I'm afraid I...
Well, I put it to you, the attempt, not you personally, that was an attempt at a cover-up, Mr. Shapps.
I don't think so. What I understand is that some further information came to light yesterday. That's a conversation between the chief whip and the individual MP concerned. He denies these allegations. It should be added, but it's quite right that a proper investigation takes place and that he doesn't sit as a Conservative in the meantime. And I think that's a sensible approach.
So, some new information apparently came up yesterday. No connection then to that also being most likely the Times deadline for comment before running their story. Helen, do you agree with Shapps' analysis there?
Well, I'm glad Nick Ferrari said, oh, well, this is clearly an attempt at a cover-up. Or he put it to Grant Shapps that it potentially could be their attempt at a cover-up. Oh, well, the Times are going to go public with it. Well, I guess we've got to get ahead of that. I mean, I couldn't possibly comment on those kind of allegations put towards the Conservative Party. But one thing I really wanted to pick up on here is this comparison with like the Angela Rayner story, is if one person acting in accordance with advice before that they were an MP from some kind of financial expert that then comes to light later on and they say, well, I'm going to comply with it, and if I need to pay up the money, then I will do, for example. As if this is somehow in any way analogous to anything that's gone on here from in terms of not reporting things to police, the scale of what's going on, the misuse potentially of campaign funds rather than, and if the story is correct, what would look to be a deliberate misuse of campaign funds rather than the inadvertent taking of advice which didn't turn out to be correct in Rayner's case is quite frankly ridiculous. I mean, the whole coverage of the Angela Rayner story has been ridiculous. Got Dan Hodges tweeting out daily updates on that one now, whilst we see things that are far more newsworthy and far more worthy of discussion being continually brought to light about how the Conservative Party acts. One thing I think was worth a lot of caution with these things, though, is that there's a risk. There's a big risk is this continual kind of cavalcade of kind of these stories coming out of Conservative Party MPs, whether they're true or not. Obviously, there are some ongoing investigations and levels of denial going on. But we have seen before this, even if this one turns out to be untrue, plenty of other true stories of Conservative Party MPs engaging in kind of behaviour that they should be above in terms of their positions as MPs. I mean, just look at Boris Johnson's personal history throughout politics, and they made him Prime Minister after all that. And also there's the Chris Pincher allegations. We run the risk of this kind of level of like normalizations, hyper-normalization, where if we just continually have story after story after story of Conservative Party MPs, or even MPs regardless of the party, regardless of which party they come from, because obviously no MP is perfect and no party is perfect, let alone the Labour Party, far from it. If we continue to keep having these stories of MPs engaging in mispropriety, what that will do is get the public used to this idea that this is somehow becoming of our political class, when it shouldn't be. These should be the kind of scandals that blow apart parliaments when, if they do indeed turn out to be true. I mean, is the kind of, alongside the economic woes, as we kind of did for the John Major administration with their kind of back to basics messaging and the Stephen Milligan moments that happened around it. And where we have got some of this, the surreal nadir of the ways in which our political class treat these kind of stories with a level of unseriousness. It reminded me of a moment, I think it was on the Trevor Phillips show on Shine News, the Phillips show. There's a moment when Aisha Hazarika, future unelected legislator, story for another time, was laughing and joking along with other commenters there about the story that she had about one time where allegedly Kemi Badenoch had said that she had hacked into Harriet Harman's emails. And they all just kind of laughed and joked along with each other. And this is serious. This is serious business. And I'm glad that it's currently being treated with seriousness. But if we don't, you know, treat these scandals even more broadly than they should be treated, they are being treated now, we run the risk of it becoming the new normal. And that's a problem.
I think that's a very apt point, but I wonder if it already has become the new normal just from the brief horrific times that I've been even slightly within Westminster circles, and the way everyone talks and journalists, the politicians, is just like it's one big game. But you know what? There's always hope we can change that culture. And hopefully we're doing it bit by bit through work like New Independent Media, the grassroots groups who operate systems outside of the parliament. So on that note, I will say thank you so much, Helena, for joining me tonight.
It's been an absolute pleasure. Thank you as always.
Thank you to everyone for tuning in despite my sickness and lethargy. Make sure to come back tomorrow. Come back tomorrow for another stream from 6 p.m. You know where we are by now. Just come and watch us. You have been watching Navarra Media. Good night.
This broadcast is brought to you by Navarra Media. Go to navarramedia.com/support.